You know, even if you're 10 feet off the shore of the Gulf of Mexico in 2 feet of water, there's a shark around here somewhere. You know, I'm going to get out of here. What about this fear of public transportation? Post-September 11th, okay, big qualifying factor there, but post-September 11th, people feel more vulnerable in public, crowded places where they have less control of their surroundings. When you're driving your own car, you can stop if you feel uncomfortable, but it's not as simple as that on a bus or a subway. Other people may be worried about germs also found in subways and buses and things. So that's another one. Another fear of storms. Okay, fear of storms often develops based on past experiences. Okay, what would probably be the best example of a storm that has caused grave fear across our nation in recent past? Katrina, right? Imagine you were affected by Katrina and you had to leave the Louisiana, Mississippi area. It would be rational for you to now have somewhat of a fear of storms because of your past experiences. Somebody who's lived through a tornado or earthquake likely remembers it, and they can actually develop anticipatory anxiety. In other words, once you see what weather can do, it's not hard to imagine the worst. Okay? Number six, closed spaces. Okay? Anybody kind of claustrophobic? Don't raise your hand. People with claustrophobia often describe it as feeling trapped without an exit. Claustrophobia involves emotional and physical reactions to triggering situations. Even small spaces with windows can sometimes invoke this kind of fear. Number seven, tunnels and bridges. Going through a tunnel or bridge can make some people feel vulnerable. Not only does it momentarily trap you, but it also requires trust in the people who built the structure. Just like a closed space, a tunnel or bridge can make the mind start mulling the what ifs. I used to travel with Cedarville singing team, like Heartsong. It was here not too long ago. And we had the southeast portion of the country when I toured. And have any of you crossed, I don't remember the name of it, and I meant to look it up and I forgot, but that real huge long bridge that covers like the Chesapeake Bay, and it goes from like Virginia to Delaware or something. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like a 7 mile or 8 mile long bridge. And it's extremely, and in fact, doesn't it like go over the water and then down under the water and then back up? Yeah. If you are afraid of bridges and tunnels, please stay away from that. Okay? You get them both, and you're on the road. You're on this thing for about 20 minutes. Well, I toured with a girl who had a bit of this fear. When she knew we were going on this, she tried her best to convince me to go around. And she was serious. And we're talking like a 500-mile out-of-the-way trek. I'm like, I am not going to do that. We're going to go over this bridge. So she sat alone in the back seat, which the back seat seats four. So the other three had to cram up in the other seats. She sat alone in the back seat the whole with her hands over her ears and her eyes closed. She did not want to know where we were driving. She was a good example of this. She was afraid that the people who built the bridge didn't know really what they were doing, and at the moment our van is going across the weak point, it's going to break, you know, and we're going to go into the water. All right, number eight, fear of crowds. Just like being in a closed space or transportation, public people can fear crowds because they worry about being able to get out of them. Beyond concern about being trapped, crowds also add the extra nerve-wracking element of evaluation. If I start to freak out, everybody's going to see me. That kind of thing. And then finally, number nine, public speaking. Fear of public speaking tends to develop when we're self-conscious adolescents. People feel like they're being judged and worry about what they sound and look like. Ultimately, their fear is of embarrassing themselves. Okay, so nine fears, you probably find yourself in there at least on one or two. Well, we all face a variety of fears. You may include any of those mentioned above. In addition to that, your fears may also involve concerns for your children, okay, concerns for your job, okay, just your security at home. Your fears may also focus on what others think of you or what you think of yourself, which we talked a little bit about last week. Your fears may heighten when confronted by a superior, or if you are a superior, when questioned by someone beneath you. Your immediate reaction might be to get defensive, which, by the way, is an element of fear of people. Okay, your fears may heighten when you realize that someone may see you for who you really are and not who you want them to think you are. Well, there's a problem with that. We may not be immobilized by these fears, Okay? It's not as though we can't function, so why is there a problem with that? Well, the problem with our fears is not the fear itself, but what they reveal about our concept of God. You see, and here's the nitpicky detail of the day here. When we choose to fear people, we are choosing not to believe, trust, depend on, fear God. And we have got to get that right in our heads. Last week we talked about how we cannot fear both God and man at the same time. Only one can control our lives, either God or man, but never both. And we have to come to grips with that and then change where necessary. So fear of man, quickly, let's redefine this from last week. Fear of man is a concern about my standing or perception in the eyes of others, which energizes disobedience, disbelief, or rebellion towards God. Secondly, being concerned with the approval of man, more concerned with the approval of man than the approval of God. Three, anxiety over the approval of man, which inhibits spontaneous and joyful obedience to the Holy Spirit. We don't want to look dumb. If God's prompting me to do something that's out of the norm, don't really want to do that because I'm afraid everybody will see me. Four, the desire to please man more than God. Okay? All that is by way of introduction. Now, if you have your Bibles, we're going to turn to Numbers 13. Okay? Numbers is the fourth book of the Bible. It's right before Deuteronomy. But in Numbers 13, we read about 12 spies of Israel, 10 of whom were gripped with fear despite the promise of God. They could not see past their own inadequacies, so they rejected God's promise. Okay, two others, on the other hand, knew that God was above their inadequacies, knew that God could work in spite of their inadequacies, and trusted in God's promise. Okay? So just basically some brief context here. In Numbers 13, we find the nation Israel. 2 months earlier, they were at the foot of Mount Sinai, where God gave the Ten Commandments. And we know what happened there. Moses came down off the mountain and saw Israel involved in pagan idolatry. They had created a golden calf, and they were worshiping the golden calf. And Moses, in his anger, broke the Ten Commandments, the tablets. Okay, so we see that Israel has a history of turning from God and looking to themselves. But 2 years before this, okay, 2 months with Sinai, 2 years, guess where they are? They're in Egypt. So 2 years before Numbers 13, they are slaves. Okay, they're God's chosen people, and they're living in a foreign land. God miraculously, through the 10 plagues, rescues them out of Egypt. We know that story. Gives them the dry land through the Red Sea. I mean, Israel has seen God in their lives for 2 years now. And you would think that with those things in their background, and those things in their history, knowing God is real, when they come to Numbers 13, you kind of expect a certain reaction by Israel. You kind of expect them to say, God's alive, let's go and do this. Okay? They're at the edge of the promised land in Numbers 13. God promised them the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. They're at the edge of this land, ready to go in and take it. Okay, ready to go in and redeem this promise. In fact, look in verse 2 of chapter 13. 1 says, "And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Send men that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel." Okay? God's giving this land to Israel. Okay? The antithesis is they're not going in and conquering the land on their own. The land is gift-wrapped for them. It was promised to them. And God is saying, this is your land. Go in and take possession of it. So Moses sends one leader from each of the 12 tribes, sends one leader into the land first to spy out the land. It's really just to do a surveillance trip. All right, to see what the people are like in the land, to see what the land is like, etc. But look at some of the names in these verses here. In verse 4, you see the name Shammua, which means renowned. Okay, he's pretty imposing, kind of a tough guy to deal with. Verse 5, you have Shaphat, which means judge, another tough guy. Verse 3, Egal means he will vindicate. All right? 4, Amiel means my kinsman is God. 5, Guel means majesty of God. And then you have little old Caleb, whose name means dog. Okay, not that imposing. Not that imposing. But as we'll soon find out, Caleb's worldview is bound to collide with the worldview espoused by the others. And frankly, he lives up to much beyond his name, dog. And of course, Joshua was another spy. Joshua and Caleb were the only ones, we'll find out, who came back trusting God. So what was their mission? Well, look down in verse 17 of chapter 13. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and he said unto them, get you up this way southward, and go up into the mountain, and see the land, what it is, and the people that dwell therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many. Verse 19, and what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds, and what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, whether there be wood therein or not, and be ye of good courage, and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So their mission basically was to head north, okay, through the Negev desert, into the hill country, which was become ultimately what we know now as Judah, all right? And then they were to head on to the area later known as Galilee. Their task was to check out the land and the people. Their trek actually covered a distance of 250 miles one way. So these 12 men set out, and they go 250 miles one way, 250 miles back, and they complete it in a time frame of 40 days. Okay, so the mission is a success. Okay, look in verse 21. So they went up and searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob, as men come to Hamath. And they ascended by the south, and they came unto Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the children of Anak, were. And they came unto the brook. Anak actually means long neck. Okay? So these men that they saw were pretty tall people. They had long necks, apparently. Verse 23, and they came unto the brook of Eshcol, and cut down from there a branch with one cluster of grapes. And they bare it between two upon a staff. Huge cluster of grapes. Okay? And of the pomegranates and of the figs. The place was called the brook of Eshcol, because of the cluster of grapes which the children of Israel cut down from thence. And they returned from searching of the land after 40 days. So they do it. It's a success. They go out and they accomplish the task that God had appointed for them to do. Okay? At least in some sense, they accomplish the task. And here's where the ugly foe of people fearing enters the picture here in Numbers 13. We need to notice, okay, in this next section, as you read down through, this first point there on your outline in your bulletin. Number one, fear of man encourages human wisdom and flawed alternatives. Okay, fear of man encourages human wisdom and flawed alternatives. And right under that, letter A, fear refuses to see what God promises. Fear refuses to see what God promises. And verse 26, these spies come back. It says, and they went and came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel under the wilderness of Paran, to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, we came unto the land. What does it say then? It says, where you sent us. So there's an interesting note that needs to be brought out here. Is earlier in the chapter in verse 2, the land was referred to the land that God gave them. And now the spies, when they come back from surveying the land, they come back and they say, the land where you sent us. There's a shift of perception. Going into the land, they know the promise. This is God's promised land for us. Coming out of the land, after seeing what was in the land, they now say to Moses, this is the land where you sent us. There's a paradigm shift. There's a worldview shift. There's a focus shift. It's no longer focusing, they are no longer focusing on God. Now they're seeing land through their own eyes. Okay? They agree with what was promised about the land. It does flow with milk and honey. They say that. It does flow with milk and honey. But what's interesting is that at this point, they pull out this cluster of grapes so extensive that it could only be carried by two men. You've probably seen in some of Hollywood's renditions of movies based around biblical times when they carried the Ark of the Covenant. This is indeed how they carried it, but they would have a man on each pole, and the Ark was suspended between the four men, and they would carry the Ark that way. Well, this is how these men brought back this cluster of grapes. It was such a large cluster, indicating the fruitfulness of the land. Such a large cluster of grapes, they slung it over a pole, and two men carried it back on their shoulders. And they bring that out here. Look in verse 27. And when they told him, it said, "We came into the land where you sent us." Okay, bad saying there. But, "And surely it does flow with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it." So they agree, and they pull out the fruit. Okay, remember, this is in front of the whole congregation of Israel. But look at verse 28. My version says, "Nevertheless." Okay, some of your versions might say, "But." All right, but here comes the but of verses 28 and 29. Look what they say. "Nevertheless, the people are strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan." See, they know that what God said is true. The land flows with milk and honey. The land is fruitful. But their focus is elsewhere. Their focus is on the people. The focus is on the great walled and fortified cities. The focus is on these tall people, the sons of Anak, the long necks. Okay? Instead of seeing God's great promise in the land as confirmation that they can enter Canaan, they see the insurmountable obstacles to their entry in the form of fortified cities. God hasn't let them down. God said the land would flow with milk and honey. It does flow with milk and honey. His promise has indeed been true. But instead of them focusing on the promise, they focus on what seems to be impossible odds. There's no way we can beat these people. How many of you have ever gone through, say, Kenwood Town Center, and there's like a jaguar sitting in the middle of the floor, you know, surrounded by yellow tape, and you're like, wow. If you like cars like me, wow, that's a nice car. Me and Becky always try to guess how much it is. I'm going to say it's $65,000. I always win. About $65,000. Well, what do they typically have at the front of these things? They have like free vacation giveaway, right? And there's a little box there with a slit cut out, and you're supposed to fill out all this personal information. You're supposedly going to get a free vacation. How many of you fill those out? Identify yourselves. Come on. Okay, we got a few over here, okay? All right, well, I typically don't, because I did it once or twice, and, you know, sure, they give you a free vacation, but, like, you have to get yourself to Florida or something, or Los Angeles, you know, you got to buy the airfare, whatever it is. So I don't do it anymore. Well, guess where I saw one of these little giveaways, drawings the other day? Of all places, Home Depot. Home Depot, now they're creeping into the, you know, the good old manly stores of Home Depot. Well, I'm leaving Home Depot. I got some little thing in my hand. And I look over, and there's a free $500 gas card. Thinking, whew, that'd be nice right about now, with oil where it is and gas where it is. So I didn't really read as to what exactly was going to happen to me, but I thought, I'll just enter it. So I went over and filled out my information, and I get this phone call, you know, two or three days later. Here, what I have to agree to is an hour-long presentation in my house by a water purification company. Okay? Rainsoft, for any of you who are out there. No, Rainsoft, they're going to come in and give me an hour-long presentation on this water purification system. So I'm thinking, yeah, okay, for an hour? And then I asked the guy, I said, well, what are the odds of me winning, you know? Before you come and take up an hour of my time, is there a chance I might win this $500 gift card? And he says, well, actually, we only have those boxes here at Tylersville and up in Springboro. I'm thinking, oh, okay, pretty good odds. And please don't go out and fill out this form. That decreases my odds. Okay. So anyway, this really nice guy calls. He's like, hey, we'd like to send out one of our salespeople to your house. Is Monday 5:30 okay? Yeah, Monday 5:30 will be fine. And he's like, well, we need your wife there. We pretty much need all the inhabitants of the household there. It's like, okay, well, I've got two kids, 4 and 2. Their attention span is about 30 seconds. Are you ready for that? He says, oh, yeah, this will be really fun. You know, a lot of colors in the water and stuff. Okay. So they come out. A really nice guy named Ryan. Really nice guy. And he starts testing our water. And, of course, my suspicions were true. You know, we've got hard water. We've got chlorine in our water. And that's why you get all the scale build up on your shower heads and your faucets. And all. You probably all get the same thing. You know, why we get a metallic taste in our water. So anyway, he does this really cool demonstration for me. He has this little mini purifier, and he runs my tap water through the purifier, and then he does all these cool, really cool, I mean, really cool things. Like this one thing he did was he took a glass of tap water, and he put in some chlorine identifying agent and immediately turned yellow, indicating there's chlorine in my tap water. Then he takes another glass of tap water and has Becky put her fingers in it and swish her fingers around, same exact tap water, pulls her hands out. He puts the same identifying agent in that water, doesn't even turn colors. I said, well, that's weird. Why is that? And he says, well, Becky just absorbed the chlorine that was in your water. Oh, great. Wow, I didn't know that, you know. Think of swimming. Think of taking a shower. I mean, how much chlorine am I absorbing every day? You know, I thought that was pretty cool. Anyway, here's my point. He comes down to the very end of it. He's done this whole huge, great presentation of this water purification system. It's like a 3-tank system that would go down in my basement. It's got a computer, self-clean, the whole deal. Of course, what you're thinking what I'm thinking. You know, what's this going to cost me? So he pulls out and goes, we're going to do it. We're going to give you a 5% discount because you're a pastor. No lie. I'm not lying. Apparently the owner of the company is a pastor. And he says, $5,700 to do a whole house purification system. Man, I wanted that. But I can't get past that price. It's like sticker shock. Have any of you ever gone to, you see the car you want, and you know, you start walking around it on the passenger side, and you get over to the driver's side window, and there's the sticker. You get sticker shock. It's like, oh my goodness, there's no way I can afford that. Israel standing on the promised land. God has promised them this land. They cannot get past the people. But here's what's different between Israel and me and my water purification system. I got to buy it. Israel didn't have to. God gave it to them. God gave them the promised land. This land is your land. Just go in and take it. I am with you. No matter what the people in the land do, I am with you. Fear refuses to see what God promises. Letter B, fear rebukes those who would remind us of the promises. Okay, fear rebukes those. Look in verse 30. Here's Caleb, all right? I said we'd see a little bit more from him a little bit later. Well, here it is. Caleb stills the people, indicating that the people were in an uproar. The spies had done their job. They had convinced the nation, this is not a good land for us to take. God is not with us. The people are huge. Caleb stills the people before Moses, and he says, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. Now, why in the world would he be able to say that? One spy says, we can overtake the land, because he is remembering the promise of God. The other spies and the people are forgetting God. Caleb standing up like the light in the darkness and saying, no, people, God has promised us this land. Don't fear the people of Canaan. Fear God. Do you see the two worldviews here? Okay? At this point, the biased attitude of the other spies just bursts onto the scene as they categorically contradict Caleb. And now they're going to defame the land. Look in 31. But the men that went with him said, we be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they brought up an evil report of the land, which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, the land through which we have gone to search is a land that eats up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. See, now their report turns from being a positive one to a completely negative one. Now they're defaming not only the land, but their very God by saying the blessing and the gift from God is now eating us alive. You see what's happening? They're just falling farther and farther down into this mire of, distrust and disbelief of God. This is what they're seeing here is a picture of a dad who takes his son into a Toys R Us and goes into a toy aisle and says, "Son, look at all these toys. I have the money to buy every single one of these for you. In fact, I'm going to buy these for you." And he just lays it all out there for his son and then turns on his heel and says, "But you know what? You'll have none of that today. Let's go get in the car." That's what they're presenting God to be like. Someone who says, "You can have all this land. This is the promised land. Oh, but you know what? You're not going to have it because the people are strong. The people are mightier than you. They lived in walled cities." That's what they think God is. You know, sometimes for us, we sang about this earlier, we sing about God's grace. And we read in His Word of the mighty work that He's done for us. But fear sometimes causes us to say, "I only see the giants in my life." Okay? God's grace over my sin? Forget it. God's love for me when I sin again? Forget it. Why do you think we've read Psalm 103 the last 2 weeks? God takes our sin and removes it as far as the east is from the west. It is time for us to start trusting in that. It's time for us to put all our chips in that basket, that God's going to do what He said He's going to do. He's going to forgive me of my sin. When He looks on me, He's going to see Jesus Christ and His righteousness, not mine, because I have none. And He's going to remove my sin as far as the east is from the west. Well, the Israelites think freedom is milk and honey. And they also think that Moses is supposed to lead them into the promised land quickly and comfortably. But when the obstacles loom, their freedom becomes chaos, and you know what? They want to actually go back to their lives of slavery. They say, "Oh, would it have been better for us never to have left Egypt?" What a horrible thing to say. However, Caleb, he sees the obstacles as a chance for God to come down and once again reveal Himself to the people. It's as if He's saying, "Guys, you know, pull your bootstraps up, pull your kids in tight. Let's go. We're going in. And God's going with us." So we have two basic human orientations here, and everyone in this room falls under one of these. Number one, faith in the Lord to overcome impossible odds. Luke 1:37, mark it down. Luke 1:37 says, "For with God, nothing is impossible." With God, nothing is impossible. That's one orientation. The second one is lack of faith, which forces humans to try and save ourselves. Okay? So let me encourage you today. Align yourself with the first one. Live your life for God. For the person of faith, obstacles are temporary because God is real. For the disbeliever, obstacles are permanent because God is not real enough. The question then for each of us today is God real to me? Do I believe, do I act, and do I live as if He is alive? One of my favorite authors through college and in the seminary was a man by the name of Philip Yancey. You've probably read some books or excerpts by him. In his book, Reaching for the Invisible God, What Can I Expect to Find? He writes this in regard to his relationship with God. He says, "Sometimes I treat you as a substance, a narcotic, like alcohol or Valium, when I need a fix to smooth over the harshness of reality or take it away. I can sometimes ease off from this world into an awareness of an invisible world, and most of the time I truly believe it exists, as real as the world of oxygen, grass, and water." And here's where he really hits us. He says, "But how do I do the reverse and let the realness of your world, God, of you, enter in and transform the numbing sameness of my daily life and my daily self?" How do we let God in? He may not come in when we want Him to, all right? He may throw things our way that aren't in our little world, that aren't in our little plans. But what do we do to act like He exists? Do we have enough evidence? Absolutely. 1 John 1:1. We have eyewitness testimony to the incarnate Christ. We also have in Romans 1:20, For since the creation of God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Listen, we may never experience a dry path through a body of water like Israel did when they crossed the Red Sea. We may never get bread from heaven on the grass in the morning when we wake up. We may never get a cloud in the sky that's visibly leading us as we walk through life. We may never get a pillar of fire at night. But listen, if we pray one day, God, help me to love person A, person B, whomever, with a more unselfish love tomorrow than I did today, and if that happens, you have the greatest miracle of all. You have a changed heart. You see, we're looking for miracles in about this much of a scope. Miracles happen every day. They do. We just don't see them because our definition is so narrow. The miracle of birth. How in the world does that happen? The miracle of your eye. You know, the miracle of your body. The miracle of just life in general, and that we don't, you know, that if the earth was just, you know, X amount of feet closer to the earth, we'd burn up. The sun, rather, closer to the earth, we'd burn up. Or X amount of feet farther away, we'd freeze. Those things. Okay, and then letter C under this. Fear replaces God's promises with flawed alternatives. Okay, persuaded by the native scouts that it is hopeless to attempt to conquer Canaan, the Israelites conclude that the Lord is their enemy and their best option is to mutiny against Moses. Look in chapter 14. All the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept at night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God that we had died in this wilderness? And wherefore hath the Lord brought us unto the land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return unto Egypt? And they said one to another, let us make a captain, and let us return into Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation and of the children of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. And they spoke unto the company of the children of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to search, it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into the land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Verse 9, only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. I love that. They are bread. We're going to squash them. And their defense is departed from them. And the Lord is with us, fear them not. Well, Moses and Aaron, they fall down on the ground. They're petitioning for the very people that want a mutiny against them. They fall on the ground. They say in verse 7, they remind the people that the land is good. In verse 8, they remind the people that the entrance into the land is still dependent on God. I mean, they just are doing their best to get these people to realize that they serve the Almighty God. Well, how did the people respond? Look at verse 10. But all the congregation bade stone them with stones. The people picked up stones and they're about to kill the very men who are saying, look on the promises of God. Now, y'all don't pick up stones and throw them at us. But sometimes we try to encourage you to focus on God's promises. To focus. I mean, what we talk and what we preach and teach you is God's word. And it's so important for you to realize that God has made so many promises to you. We need to live according to those promises. You know, oftentimes we are a lot like Israel. We lose faith in God, by and large, his promises, and then we jump into the driver's seat of our lives, and we try to drive our own lives, and what happens? We wreck. We wreck every time. In Psalm chapter 30, I believe, or 31, David says, my times are in your hands, O God. My times are in God's hands. It's when I try to take them back. Okay? So God has to step back in here in verse 10, and he has to correct the Israelites, which leads to our second major point, we're done with this one. Number 2, fear of man forces God's intervention and corrected perspective. Fear of man forces God's intervention and corrected perspective. Okay, so the murderous threats from these people, they're picking up stones, they're about to kill Moses, Aaron, Joshua, and Caleb. These murderous threats are enough. God manifests himself in the middle of the nation Israel. And can you imagine this? You know, this rampaging rage that these people are feeling right now must have turned to just trembling terror. Here's God. What have we done? Look at the end of verse 10. And the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. So God appears to Moses. Moses, up to this point, hasn't said anything. But now he finds his voice, and what does he do? He pleads for the lives of the children of Israel. Look in verse 11. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people provoke me, and how long will it be before they believe me for all the signs which I have shown among them? I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them and make of thee a great nation and mightier than they. So God's going to start over with Moses. He says, I'm sick and tired of them not believing me. Well, Moses, back down in 19, he interjects. He finally speaks up. A man of few words, a man who doesn't have the gift of eloquence, a man who didn't want to go stand before Pharaoh. That's what he says here. Pardon or forgive, I beseech thee, the iniquity of this people according unto the greatness of thy mercy. And as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. And the Lord said, I have pardoned according to thy word. See, God grants forgiveness and he preserves the nation, but here's the key here. He doesn't remove punishment. Okay? God grants forgiveness and he preserves the nation, but he does not cancel divine punishment. God continues in his decree and he enacts punishment upon the nation for their disbelief. I have a slide up here I'd like you to see. It'll kind of illustrate the punishment. This is how God cursed the nation for their disbelief here on the edge of the promised land. Up in the top left, it says, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron. Okay, bookend number one. God is speaking here. Okay, how long will you grumble? I'm sick and tired of you not believing me. Okay, in this desert, your bodies will fall. Okay, over to the right, your children will be brought in. Okay, the children are going to be allowed into the promised land. Your bodies will fall in this desert. Your children will shepherd for 40 years in this desert. 40 years, 1 year for each of the 40 days I, the Lord, have spoken. Okay? So basically what God is saying to you, because of your disbelief, because you didn't trust in my promises, I'm removing the promised land from you for a period of 40 years. One generation will die. One generation will die. Look over in verse 37. Even those men that did bring up the evil report upon the land died by the plague before the Lord. The 10 spies who came back and convinced the nation to not believe God, they died immediately. God took their very lives as a symbol or to really stamp on the hearts of the children of Israel that he means business. Because you didn't believe in me, I'm now going to punish you for it. I'm going to send you back into the wilderness. The irony here is incredible, and if you didn't see it, go back to verse 2, chapter 14. And all the children murmured against Moses and against Aaron, okay? This is when they're starting to hear the reports. And the congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land, or would God that we had died in this wilderness? Guess where they're going to die? They're going to die in the wilderness. God grants them their request. Not only that, but in verse 3 of chapter 14, they seem to think that their children are helpless. They say, would it be better to fall by the sword that our wives and our children should be a prey? In fact, though, the children are the only ones that will survive. Isn't that interesting? Our children are helpless. No, your children are the only ones who are going to go in. I forgot to give you letter A, I think. God's forced intervention and correction are always more difficult than initial obedience. Okay, letter A under number 2 there. God's forced intervention and correction are always more difficult than initial obedience. We have got to learn that. We've got to learn that. Letter B then. When God removes an opportunity, attempting to take back that opportunity is another act of rebellion. when God removes it, attempting to take it back is another act of rebellion. The Israelites in verse 40 say, hey, we've sinned. They acknowledge they've sinned. God's removed the land from us because we have sinned. Now, if they attempt to seize back the land, that would be another act of rebellion. Well, let's see what they do. Verse 40, and they rose up early in the morning and gat them up into the top of the mountain, saying, lo, we be here, and we will go up unto the place which the Lord has promised, for we have sinned. 41, Moses said, do not transgress the commandment of the Lord, but it shall not prosper. Go not up, for the Lord is not among you, that ye be not smitten before your enemies. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and you will fall by the sword. Because you are turned away from the Lord, therefore the Lord will not be with you. But they presumed to go up under the hilltop. Nevertheless, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and Moses departed not out of camp. And guess what happens? 45. Then the Amalekites came down, and the Canaanites which dwelt in that hill, and smote them, and pursued them, even unto Hormah. See, at first, they were unwilling to go where God was leading. Now they want to go where God is not leading. They've made two grave mistakes here. And we know the expression, two wrongs don't make a right. They messed up in the beginning, and now they're saying, oh, God, you know, we're sorry, we've sinned. Okay, we'll go in and, you know, because now they have the penalty behind them. Now they're going to go back into the wilderness and wander for 40 years and die off. So what do they say? God, we're, you know, can we still get that land? You know, could you maybe still kind of give us? God says, no, you did not believe me. What do? They instead try to go in anyway. So they're decimated and they're pursued. What a humiliating circumstance for the nation Israel. God's chosen people, decimated by the people who live in the promised land, not only killed by them, but then pursued by them. Jason Kidd, when he was drafted to the Dallas Mavericks, and he said it so eloquently, we're going to turn this team around 360 degrees. That's what Israel did here. You know, their first mistake was to not believe God, but then their second mistake was to try to take back the opportunity that God took from them. So conclusions here on the bottom of your notes there. How does this relate to us today? Well, let me give you, how do we ensure that we adopt a worldview of belief? That's got to be our worldview. We've got to believe God. How do we ensure that? Well, number one, foster a healthy influence on others. Especially with regard to attitude or attitude-shaping pieces of information that can be passed on without control with one person to another. Gossip, slander, paranoia, sensationalism. Get rid of all that and make sure that you're fostering a worldview of belief on each other. Number two, critique influences on you no matter how compelling they look. Critique influences on you no matter how compelling they look. Don't allow them to lead you to make damaging choices. The 10 spies came back and influenced the people to not believe God. Don't allow people to do that to you. Three, keep things in perspective and don't run or jump just because all the other lemmings do. Okay? You make your own decisions. Don't run and jump off a cliff just because everybody else is doing it. Don't do what the nation Israel did. And four, finally, maintain personal anchor points of faith and ethics to hang on to when everything else seems to be shifting fast. In other words, know what you believe and why you believe it. It's so important for you to understand doctrine. It's important for you to understand God. It's important for you to find those anchor points in your life that when things shift, you hang on. Okay, so fear of man. Well, let me encourage you with this thought. Be somebody who believes God, knows that He says He'll never leave you nor forsake you no matter what happens in your life. Believe that. Stand on the, if you will, figuratively, stand on the boundary of your promised land and step over and grab it, resting on the promises of God. Okay? Can we stand together? Let's pray in that direction now, and we'll close our service here in just a moment or two. Would you bow your heads with me and close your eyes? Like I challenged you last week, just remove everything away. Pretend there's nobody next to you. There's nobody in front of you. Nobody behind you. It's you and God right now. And I need you to be brutally honest with yourself. Do some evaluation. Ask yourself this morning, Do I live and act as though I believe God exists? Do I live and act as though I believe God exists? If people were to look in